You're listening to a Bucks Plus audio production on the Bucks Plus Network.
Your weekly pulse on the Milwaukee Bucks, straight from a Bucks legend. This is Here District with Marcus Johnson, alongside his son and 1995 NCAA champion, Chris. Here's MJ.
All right, everybody. Welcome to Here District. I'm the captain of this vessel, Marcus Johnson, my son Chris Johnson. We're the only father and son tandem in the history of the NCAA to win a national championship at the same school, UCLA. What's up, Chris?
Feeling, baby.
All right. Now, look, so we got a special guest in the house tonight. And, man, we go way, way back. Baron Davis. Man, Baron, yes, welcome to Here District. What an honor. What a privilege. Brandon Jennings said you're the godfather of Los Angeles basketball. How's that make you feel, man? He's a godfather. You're a godfather now.
You know, it's I sit on the back of the wise man, right? So if I think it's an honor, but I'm nothing without Marcus Johnson, right? Nothing without Marcus Johnson. Come on, man. The Marcus Johnsons, the Dwayne Polis, the Casper Wares, you know, the J Dubs, the John Williams. And you talking about, you know, it's so many legends. You know, look what Chris accomplished as well, you know, as the big OG, right? And so for me, like talking about being a godfather, it's like I report to the wise man. My DNA is in the wise man because sure. There's somebody behind that you gotta have counsel with. And you know, the beauty of LA is we all know our history and we all pay homage. I would say, you know, and for me it's like that's all I wanna do. You know, so being on this show, you know, I'm the biggest Marcus Johnson fan.
Well, I appreciate you.
I'm the biggest Chris Johnson fan. You know why? Because I knew where I needed to go to get a bucket down the stretch. You feel me? On that elbow? Okay. On that elbow? Come on, dude. My goodness.
But look, man, so this whole L.A. connection, your relationship with Chris, my first coming in contact with you, man, it started like in around 1989, 90. Michael Solomon, former Crenshaw Cougar, ran a great program at the Inglewood YMCA. Yeah. And the coach of Chris's team, my best friend, the son of Maxine Waters, Ed Waters, current coach of Crenshaw, he kept telling me, man, have you seen this kid named Baron? I'm like, nah, what's Baron? What, 10 years old, whatever. I'm telling you, he's special. I saw you play at the Inglewood YMCA, man, and he was right on the money. But just, what do you remember about those days? Paul Pierce came up through that same program that same year. Just how competitive that was. How did that help shape you in terms of who you eventually turned out to be?
I remember it like it was yesterday. I just talked to Mike Kale. I was telling Mike Kale he played for Michigan. He was bigger than everybody. He was like a Jalen Rose, Chris Webber. I was like, man, who is this? I was the smallest dude out there. But, you know, coming from, South Central, that was my first time really ever getting out the hood. Usually it was Bethune Park. So I, you know, grew up Bobby Watson, Casper Ware. Yeah, Watch musicians, Camp Fundamentals, and all of our games was like Bethune Park. You know, I get out of church. We was on Slauson and Compton, 55th and Morgan. And so all that was like East Side. When I got to Inglewood, it was like, man, this is like a home. This is what is this? You know, I'm by the farm. Yeah. Like we can walk around, right? It's at the YMCA, and then I start seeing like I saw Andre Miller.
Yeah.
I saw Paul Pierce. I saw Milton Palacio. Yeah. Right? And I was like, damn, you know, it's some ballers. Keith Kincaid. That wound up going to Dominguez. And remember Burgers? It was a dude named Burgers.
Oh, yeah.
He was called too. And like my first taste of Inglewood was – like that kind of took me to a whole nother place, right? Because it was like, okay, I get to leave Manchester and San Pedro, man, and go all the way to Manchester and Crenshaw. That's like, man, that's damn near Disneyland, right? Yeah. And you had a park, you know, and it was so great because, you know, Darby Park is you know, they the same site and the same color as my color over there. So it was just like, I ain't had no worries.
You was chilling, DD.
Oh, man. I wasn't worried about nothing, dude. Because, you know, as a kid, you just know what's in your neighborhood. Right. So Inglewood was like, wow, like that wasn't like gangbanging wasn't prevalent.
Right.
It was sports. So that's all I knew Inglewood for, the Lakers, sports, football, basketball. And so that kind of shaped like my appreciation for like, damn, like somebody care about me to like take me somewhere outside of L.A. That's not the East Side.
And so now moving forward, man, the first time I saw you in high school, I showed up at Crossroads. I think Josiah might have been a seventh grader at Crossroads in your younger years. But you were sitting on a lunch table. You had on a wig. You kind of dressed up, but you were rehearsing a scene or doing something. And somebody was over to you, whatever. But it was cool because I'm a drama guy myself. But just that Crossroads, Kate Hudson, Zoe Deschanel, Jack Black. I mean, that had to be just a fascinating experience for a kid coming out of South Central to be thrust into that environment at Crossroads High School.
Oh, man, it was crazy because it was like everything you saw on TV was actually happening, you know, at the school, or a lot of their parents were behind the scenes. So it gave me a look of a whole nother level of LA where it was like, oh, like, damn, you don't have to fail, right? Like you could be, you know, working in Hollywood as a stage manager, right? Or, you know, you can be working in basketball as the ticket person, you know, at the Forum, right? And Crossroads kind of opened my world up to like, hey, man, there is no failing, you know, when you come this far. And then on the art side, it was art was an expression, right? Art is how you know, deal with trauma. And so that allowed me to understand that these kids were just the same as I was.
Yeah.
Right. And they had struggles, maybe different struggles than I had struggles. They had different, you know, they may have places to go and a home and all that to go to that was bigger, but they had a lonely home too, you know, and whether it was divorce. And so you start learning like, damn, like what's divorce? Right.
Right.
Like what's divorce? What's, you know, you start learning all this and you realize like, you know, art is an opportunity to like relieve some of that trauma. And so that's why Crossroads for me was so fascinating. I took pottery class. I took dance class. I took drama class. Man, I still got some of them sculptures. I still be going to the pottery shop. Right. And then I think from the basketball side of it, I saw how focused those kids were.
Yeah.
How much they love what they was doing. They was like, when they was acting, and you know this, Pops, you know this, you know, being an actor, it's like they was in character. Like they come into school with the wig on and the whole costume. Like, I gotta go perform at 5. I'm in character the whole time. Yeah. I didn't even understand. I didn't understand it. But I start hanging out in the drama department, just seeing how people was working. We had the best orchestra. Kids was flying in. This young lady in my class, Danielle Denise, she was from Australia. She, when we graduated, she missed graduation because she was the best opera. She was the best opera singer and was on tour.
Wow.
You know,
right? Well, the one thing it shows you, I mean, the analogy I love is the duck on the pond and how smooth they make it look, but you look underneath and the feet are just moving. I mean, the easier that you make it look, the harder you've got to work at it. The more preparation, the more diligent you've got to be at your craft, whatever that happens to be.
Yep.
And that's a fascinating point about what you picked up from these creatives, these actors, these musicians, in terms of what they did.
And BD, I had a question kind of following up on that, because as you know, I have my South Central roots. And when you go the schools that are predominantly white, and it's a lot different than your neighborhood, it sort of sometimes causes a conflict within yourself. Because now you're in a school where you're trying to adjust, adapt to the scenario, but you still got to go back to the crib. How did you balance spending that time at Crossroads, then going back over on 85th, you know, and still kind of keep staying true to who you were at your core?
Yeah, I think it's a lot of imposter syndrome, right? Because it's like you just don't fit in. Right.
Yeah.
And like as a kid, it's like, man, I was baked this way. You know what I mean? This is my view, my perception on this bubble of the world. Now I'm going all the way over here. And then hold on, what's this going? What's this like Disneyland over here? You mean I can Man, I don't have to commit a crime.
I can get this off.
Are you kidding me?
Yeah, I can make money for doing.
It's like, hold on, class? Who going to class? Oh man, I remember my ninth grade year. I had 136 tardies, 93 unexcused absences for class because I was just going to other people's class. Like, man, what do y'all do for a living? Hey, man, what are you trying? I was in drama class. They was like, you're not even in this class. I was like, I ain't tripping. Like, dumb. Can you imagine?
Oh.
Yeah, it's just you don't fit.
Yeah.
Right? You don't fit. And then you just, you trying to wiggle your way into this this middle ground, this middle class where you can, like, be both, right? Because you're expanding. And I think, you know, the hard thing is that you are the expectations.
Right.
Right. The expectations on this side versus, you know, the fight. Right. And the prove it.
Mm.
Right. Yeah. I don't have to prove to my homeboys. I just don't have to get killed. You know what I mean? Right. Real now, talk. I don't have to prove nothing to them, but I got to prove this every day. And so that whole, like, expectation and prove it, as you start making it, it's like, or you start, like, I didn't even say making it, you start learning that you can navigate both of these worlds, it becomes anxious at times.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, as you learn and grow, you realize that people are people.
Yeah.
Right? People are people. And especially in this city, it's like LA, sure. South Central, Santa Monica, two different worlds, right? Yeah. Crenshaw, Eastside, two different worlds. And so Inglewood, Crenshaw, all that is two different worlds. And so I've been always, like, I say I'm a kid at a journey from South Central to Santa Monica, stopping Crenshaw, you know, stopping Inglewood, stopping Marina Del Rey.
Yeah,
like, you just start, as you grow, and you know this, Chris, because, you know, you did it in high school, going back to Crenshaw, you know what I mean? And it's sort of like you are who you are and you just have to accept that, right? Mm-hmm. And you got to, like, let other people know that, like, man, I'm everything.
Yeah.
I'm not just this. I'm not just this. I'm all of it. I'm all of it. And it's hard for a kid from LA to be able to, like, communicate that in a city where, you know, communication is tricky.
So, Baron, let's talk about your basketball legacy, man. And I opened up the show by saying that Brandon Jennings said that you were the godfather of L.A. basketball. I mean, if you talk about the great point guards out of L.A., the all-time greats, I mean, you've got to rank top 3 to 5 in there. Raymond Lewis is the guy they always put at number one before your time.
One, two.
Yeah,
you know. Nobody else.
Five.
Wait.
Hey, 3 to 5.
Only Raymond Lewis.
Okay.
Hey, look, I was trying to think.
Well, let's talk about that. Russell Westbrook. You know, he didn't blow up until after.
Yeah,
like he wasn't that highly regarded coming out of high school when he first came out.
He got better. He got better.
Brandon Jennings was
incredible. Like,
yeah.
I would say he was the next kind of, like, incredible anomaly as far as LA point guards, right?
Yeah, young player. He went from high school to Rome, right? He
to Rome.
High school to Rome to play
but
ball.
But he left and went to Oak Hill, so.
Yeah, that's right.
We can't ride with that.
Marcus Williams, the same thing. Crenshaw left with Oak Hill. So
very nice.
Pro career, you know. Very nice.
Yeah,
hey, Jock Vaughn, you got Jock Vaughn. You got
a lot of dudes.
Yeah,
James Harden, Artesia, including him.
Yeah, right.
You know, you got to put James up there.
Somewhere. Right. So James belongs on that list. I'm trying to, and even older school, Gil Goodrich, I mean, that's before your time, early 60s, what he was doing. I mean, 44 in a championship game at UCLA. You know, so he's, you know, and that's
Dino,
you know,
Tanner.
That's going way, way back. But what do you see as your legacy? I mean, you made the All-Star team a couple of times. I mean, are you satisfied with your career? When you look back on it, do you feel a sense of fulfillment in terms of, and I know we can't change it, and I know all that,
yeah,
but
not
how
do
you feel about your legacy and how your career played out?
I think it's just now that I'm starting to really, like, watch games and enjoy watching the game just to see, like, you know, because it was almost like I didn't get a chance to, like, get over the hump. Right. It was like I was always 2 months out, a month out. Like if I had low management, you know, I think it could have been a different story. But when you think about the journey, man, come on. Off the east side, off the east side, you know, All-Star, you know, had an opportunity to go up against Iverson in the playoffs, you know, T-Mac, play against the greats, D-Wade, LeBron, Kobe, you know, Chris Paul, all the greats, even the Nick Van Exels to see John Stockton. Like, I just kind of, like, lived out my life dream, you know? And then I think about the journey again because it was, hey, I went to Crossroads and I still, like, managed to put on for the city.
Then I went to UCLA,
you know, and then I was still able to put on for the city, right? And then I went to the league, and then I never forgot about the city, right?
Yeah.
And when I look at why I got injured, how I played, right, it was a different reason when I was playing basketball. It was a different reason. It was a different outlet. It was a different joy. Right. It was a different stress reliever. Chris would tell you, like, in practice, like, man, run all day and play around all day. And when it's time to get down, it's like I'm picking up full. And, you know, I just love basketball.
Right.
And I think that was also a part of, like, why I play so hard, why I jump so, like, why I tried to dunk on big dude. I thought it was just funny. I thought it was hilarious. But that's also why I got hurt. Right.
Yeah.
So I had to figure out now, I would say later, to accept that, watch the tape, comment on the tape, and then just appreciate the journey, right?
Yeah.
Because I have a style and had a style that when I was thinking of what I was going to bring to LA, like I was thinking about how to cook up this style for LA point guards.
Yeah.
And it wasn't like, you know, I mean, you look at the great Raymond Lewis. He was just, like, incredible, like, watching his film. But up until then, there was nobody who played like that.
Right.
Could dunk, dribble, pull up, post up, get to the hole, pick up four. Like, you had L.A., you know, you think you have more of the traditional point guard, a good college point guard, maybe a scoring point guard. But for me, it was more like the style. How do I give you a little bit of Magic or Nick Van Exel. So I was just absorbing, you know, what a LA basketball player would look like. And I wanted to be like that embodiment of this next generation. And so that's why I stay connected. So overall, feel great about it.
Yeah, but and this gets me to this next question. And I've had personal experience with this. I've been a Hall of Fame finalist 3 times. I've come up short 3 times. But when I look at a guy like you, in terms of just iconic, in terms of your imprint on the game of basketball, and to be the, you know, second top two point guards in the history of a city, to be a young man that all these youngsters emulated and then patterned their games after, to get into the league and do some of the things that you did, you know, injuries notwithstanding, but to come in and, you know, dunk on, who's that dunk you had on? Was that Alonzo Mourning?
Kirilenko.
Kirilenko.
I dunked on Alonzo Mourning, too.
Yeah, he dunked on him. I mean, some of the most spectacular plays that we've ever seen for a guy your size. I mean, I don't know, man. Did you ever think about the Hall of Fame? Do you think that there's... Nope. Does it ever cross your mind in terms of the total body of work? And it's not just Hall of Fame is not the NBA Hall of Fame. It's the Basketball Hall of Fame. And your position as a basketball player, Baron, I mean, there's few from us that understand the game, from the civilians that maybe don't have that kind of an understanding. There's few guys that compare to who you are. B. Diddy, Baron Davis, when you say that name, I get excited. I get excited just thinking about what you did.
Yeah, the only thing I think about the Hall of Fame, right, is I would love to get up in a room full of my peers and give a sick story. That's all. I would write the sickest speech ever in Hall of Fame history and go down like that because, man, it's a story to tell. Yeah. And why do I deserve to be somewhere where I ain't tripping? I am not tripping.
Right.
I'm not tripping at all.
I don't blame you, bro.
I'm not tripping at all. Because you, Marcus Johnson, are a Hall of Famer. You're iconic. You're the first point forward. Nobody can take away your body of work. No one can stamp you. Your peers, everybody in your era, the era after you, everybody that fight for you, that's how we ride. Yeah, and we don't care about none of that. Because when we start looking at the overall zeitgeist of basketball, West Coast, we going to get marginalized out anyway.
Facts.
You feel what I'm saying? We just like a Snickers or something. You know what I mean? It's just a Snicker. Like we the same Snickers commercial. You know what I mean? Like we ain't even giving UCLA the credit. Like, are you kidding me?
Yeah.
It's unbelievable.
The Hall of Fame is body of work.
Yeah.
Disgusting.
Yes.
The Hall of Fame is body of work. Contributions to basketball. Go and check the facts on Marcus Johnson. Right. Crenshaw, number one team in the world in high school. UCLA. How many? Three?
Yeah, well, I'm part of one championship, but first winner of the John Wooden Award, all that good
John
stuff.
Wooden Award winner. He set the tone.
Come on, man.
We ain't playing with these people, man. For me, I look in the Hall of Fame and say, damn, I love it. You know, like, that would be cool to go and give a speech and, you know, my kids see that. But, like, it's more about what the story I want to tell.
Right.
Okay. Because we all need to hear it and we all need to kind of hear the perspective that, man, we need to make our own Hall of Fame.
Yeah. Yeah.
And there I you nominate go. You. You feel me?
And I nominate
straight
you.
Up. And I straight nominate. Up.
Yeah.
Straight right. up. I mean, straight up.
Contributions to the game. It's Come funny, on, Baron. When I got denied the second time, I was taking my daughter to an AAU game and I got my phone lit up and it was Clyde, Walt Frazier. Mm-hmm. I was like, well, I got to take this. I told her, yeah, baby, you go inside. I'll be in after the game starts. I said, like, what's up, Clyde? And Clyde had gotten rejected for the Hall of Fame. This is a man at 36 points, 19 assists in a game seven. He got rejected three or four times. He started off, Marcus, F him. F him, man. Just F him. They did the same crap to me, man. F him, man. Don't let these people define who you are as a person, as a basketball player, blah. And he'll forever be one of my favorites just because of that phone call that he gave me at that moment, you know.
Yeah. Man, nobody can define what you did.
Please.
But your peers.
Yeah. Right.
Right.
I believe it.
They know.
And I don't care about the commercials. You know what I mean? I don't care about how they commercialize the overall legacy of basketball. Like, it's just these people. Line them up. How about we do this? Line them up. Line up everybody in the Hall of Fame. right? Line them up. See where I measure out.
Yeah.
There's gotta be somebody I'm better than.
Yeah.
There gotta be somebody I'm nicer than. Come on, man. We ain't gonna do that. We ain't, you know, but like, and then that's my whole thing, right? So it's like, if I go in the Hall of Fame, somebody gonna be like, how they let him in? And I'm like, all right, dude. Right. So I'm cool. Yeah. Just leave me out of it. Leave me out of it. Because there's a part of going in that's like, man, there's some real ones.
Yeah. That, so listen, man.
Yeah.
You had this conversation.
You are the, like, when it comes to LA basketball, you're the guy.
Right. And so are you. And that's what I'm saying. When you've reached that level of being top whatever in a city, in a section of the country with some renowned talent that's come out of there. Mm-hmm. Come on. But talk about a controversial topic. Controversy is a bit of a stretch, but an interesting discussion that we've been having about a comment that LeBron made about Giannis in the 70s, 250 points. Oh, yeah,
we talked about that on the podcast with Draymond.
Yeah, you and Draymond had a conversation about
that.
They
only give Draymond credit and because he say he only respect. Yeah, I understand his take, but the fact of the matter is, can you play in Chuck Taylor's Giannis?
Yeah, right. The conditions of the time.
Hey, can you survive? Can you go and – yeah, so, like, that's how we got to respect eras, right?
Right.
We got to respect every era because the era that y'all played in, it was different conditions.
Yeah.
Right? The world was in a different place.
Yeah.
Finances was in a different place.
Yes.
Basketball was in its infancy, right? Nobody cared about basketball, but people who play basketball or people who watch basketball. Now, everybody and their mama care about basketball, right? Yeah. So, like, the commercialization of basketball or the evolution or the growth, let's say the growth, right? And the evolution of the game, it's only made it to where the players are the number one. It's a players league. They're the number one commodity. Take care of the commodity. Now, take all that care and put it in the 70s. Well, you got to tape your own ankles. You know what I mean? You got to tape your own ankles to your teammates at halftime smoking a cigarette. You know what I mean? Because they got to figure out if they're going to get a job or change careers. And you
– different.
And you come – and you a foreign player. A foreign person.
Yeah.
Right? And so you think about that. It's like some dudes can talent-wise, obviously, can transcend – every era, but you don't think it was a Giannis that played in the 70s? All them fools was built like Giannis.
Yes,
Nate Thurman looking man, like Giannis.
And you dunk on them and scream, they firing on you after the game. And ain't no, you know, like it's just different. Like this is a different type of game.
I wanted to bring this part of it up. Because I feel like it's always been neglected whenever we get into this conversation about who could play in what era. So, like, you mentioned the conditions. You mentioned the mentality of guys. In the 70s, 80s, 90s, there was a chance that you would get socked up if you were playing well. So guys would resort to do different things on the floor to take you out of your game. My question to you, BD, how much is that overstated? Are we always talking about guys today as if they're punks or as if they're soft, as if they can't handle those conditions? Like, what's your vantage on guys today being able to withstand that side of the game that existed in the 70s and 80s?
I mean, at the end of the day, basketball is art. Basketball is a gentleman's game, right? But it's also highly competitive, and it's a contact sport. Right. And so when you're looking at, you know, dudes in this, even dudes in my era, you would say, like, we weren't fighting. Right. But you had to be physical.
Yeah.
You had to put on weight. Right. Because my rookie year, I got Bobby Fields, Anthony Mason, you know, like These dudes, David Wesley, man, they living in the weight room. And if they grab you like this on your waist, like none of them shakes or none of that's like getting them. It was hard to get separation. You know what I mean? To get them off you. And so when you start looking at the physicality of the game back then, the mentality was a fighting mentality because the pot and the pool was small. I've been playing basketball all my life. If I get cut, it ain't no other place to go.
Yeah.
Ain't no social media. It ain't no, you just a, you know, tall person working at Home Depot, you know, cause you can pull the cans off, you know, that's kind of like where these dudes, you can go and play one-on-one and make $250,000 off the internet. Facts. So the skills always are transferable.
Right.
It's just the evolution of the time that is taken to create this mode of player, right? Mm-hmm. With all the people around versus self-made.
Yeah. Well, and
That was sick.
Yeah, and to Chris's point, I mean, the story I tell is there was a story about a Phoenix Suns player, great player, Hall of Fame caliber player, who came to the bench, teared up and crying. And so his teammate Dennis Johnson from Compton was like, "Bro, what's wrong with you?" And they're playing the Lakers. So this player said, "Michael Cooper just slapped me. Michael Cooper just slapped me." You know, and took this guy, and I won't say the guy's name because I don't want to put him on blast. But
you already put him on blast.
Took this guy completely out of his game. But then when I was telling Chris, but Coop was from Pasadena. That wouldn't have the same impact on me or on you. Yeah, I mean, he wouldn't think about doing anything like that. You know what I mean? Pasadena, Crenshaw, Pasadena, Eastside, LA, where you grew up.
But Coop would get down. Like, you know what I mean? No. It's like that's where people used to get it messed up. Yeah, back in y'all day, it's like, oh, okay, he from Pasadena.
He was tough, but I'm saying, but he wasn't the toughest that I'd ever seen. You know what I mean?
Right.
He was tough. But it wasn't like I'm just, Coop is going to intimidate me. It's like, you know.
Yeah, like I'm not walking around scared that Coop going to beat me up.
Exactly. I played in the Trade Tech League when the referees carried guns. Lorenzo Clark and these guys had pistols in their pockets and players were attacking each other with crutches and all. You know, you see some crazy stuff.
It was just different. Yeah. I would say, you know, the eras were built different. You were built to really, like, hate somebody. Right. Yeah. So a LA dude, a East Coast dude, like they did not like each other game. Nah. They thought each other was better than and when it was a clash, it was a real clash, right?
Yeah.
Now these kids, like they don't come from a place or a style. It's just the system is like, this is what he wants you to do. Pump fake, get a piece of the paint.
Cookie cutter.
Do the step back. You know, but like when you look at certain people like Giannis would translate. He wouldn't score 250 points, but he could translate. He would be a good player in that era.
Sure.
Giannis would be a great player. Would probably be a great player in that era, but he would have to learn a whole lot more and be on his own a whole lot more because you wouldn't have the coaches, the ecosystem, the patience, all that. None of that was around. Like, think about, you know, it was like, think about Darko Milicic.
Right.
Darko was not a bad player.
Good player. Right?
They just, nobody had time.
Right.
And nobody had time to groom Darko to be the next Rashid or whatever he wanted to be. Man, they was like, what? You don't do what? Bye. Yeah.
Right.
We're throwing you out there.
Single on your own volition.
These dudes getting drafted 19, 20, starting you 3-4 years, don't pan out, you know. So it's a lot more patience, but it's also, I would say, it's more systematic.
Right.
And so these kids are like highly skilled, they are what we all wanted to be. Mm. Right, as far as like, damn, bag. I wish I could jump that high.
They got back.
Damn, I wish I could shoot like that. Damn, I wish I could move like that. Like, just the way that, like, this era, like, and I appreciate that, right?
Right.
I really do appreciate those those guys and these guys, because it's like watching yourself in its youngest form.
Right.
Right. And so maybe the system makes them play in patterns, which causes for less originality. When right. back in the day, you had to build yourself as an original brand.
Yeah. And you had to come in, because you talk about Giannis. I mean, Giannis, there was an incubation period. He was coddled. He was nurtured. Mm-hmm. They were mm-hmm. patient with him. Mm-hmm. You know, you get into the wrong yeah. system back in the day, you was out of the league in 2 or 3 years.
Yeah, they were. Yeah. Bang.
You know, they may give you a year or two to show it. And if you don't, you know, you're out of there. If the Bucks were to somehow pull it together, Bobby Portis comes back, Dame comes back from the blood clots, you know, everybody that's injured is healthy, and they make this incredible run. They beat the Knicks in the first round. They beat the Celtics in the second round. They beat the Cavs in the finals. Giannis is turning things out, averaging 30. And why wouldn't he be MVP? Why can't you count them? And the impetus is impetus for me with this, Baron, is your playoff series against the Dallas Mavericks. Mm-hmm. When they were a one seed, you were at 8 at Golden State, Dirk Nowitzki, 67 wins, MVP, and you guys put them out in that first round. To me, it's always been about the total body of work that a player does during the course of an entire season, and I don't see anything. Back in the day, you had to have MVP ballots in through mail. Now it's computerized mm-hmm. voting, instantaneous. To me, I don't see nothing wrong with waiting to see how this thing plays out before the ballots are due. So now you can base a guy in terms of being most valuable on the totality of the season and what he does in the most important part of that season to help his team win. So just your thoughts on Giannis and where he stands between Shea and Jokic, who are great players. But, you know, just your thoughts on that.
Yeah, I would say, you know, it's really who having the best season and, you know, who's having an incredible, most unstoppable season. The year with Dirk, like, it was clear cut. He was going to be the MVP. He was on the best team, you know, and when Dallas walked in the building, you feared Dallas, but you knew Dirk, like, it wasn't nothing you was going to do to stop him. You was just hoping he was off. Right. I think that is like, kind of like now the same thing. Like it's, Giannis is third in the conversation.
Right.
Period. Like, Joker, what Joker is doing, what Shea is doing.
What's Joker doing? 16,
what is,
why are you on that? Why is everybody on that?
It's not, do you watch Joker play?
All the time.
It's, damn, I like watching him play.
Yeah.
Right?
He does play a pure brand.
And then you're watching, like, how is he doing that? He's so effective. He's the focal point of that offense. And so with a player with that much freedom,
yeah,
with that's everything the key. Going through him, right? Yeah. Every single thing, right?
Yeah.
His responsibility, attention to detail, right? And his trust is like on a whole nother level because he can do it all. He does everything.
Yeah.
He does everything. It's crazy.
Yeah.
He does everything. Then you look at Shea and you say, well, how can you beat that? Well, go watch Shea play. Because they say, oh, it's just the points. No, he locking up.
Mm-hmm.
He like one in steals, like that, yeah. You know, one or two in steals, that mean a lot.
Yeah.
Steals, like he not just like steals mean a lot. That's steals, that's deflect. That's the steals he not getting, you know, the deflections, right? Yeah. So when you watch him play, they number one in defense, right? I think they number one in defense, like team defense. And when you watch him play, you like, damn, dude, like, not only is it easy for him on offense, like, he locking up too. He's not vulnerable. So you get kind of like this Jordan-esque type of season.
Right.
Right? Kobe-esque type of season from Shea with the number one team versus Joker just having an incredible season. Right.
Well, to your point about Joker, man, I didn't realize this. I was listening to It Is What It Is with Mason Cameron, of all people. But Joker is number three in steals.
Yeah.
He's number three the third center in the history of the league to be top five in steals. That's Akeem.
Yeah.
And then Andre Drummond, which surprised me in 2017. But, I mean, he's third in steals, you know, in terms of a big man, a center, who I always looked at as a guy that didn't play defense. Defense was always a thing you could throw at him. Well, he don't play no D. He's number three in steals.
But he doesn't play D. He doesn't play D. Like, let's be real.
Don't he's number three in steals. He's doing something.
Hey, Chris,
defensive rating. Look at his defensive rating. And really, and then we can come up with how
what is his defensive rating? We can look at it.
And once we look at it, then you will say, okay, hold on. What I see from Joker a lot of times, though, is maybe he's solid defensively, but it seems like when Denver is trying to win a game or they're getting to those positions where you need to stop, I always see Joker just kind of, he's not doing a Giannis, right? Getting up to the top of the square for a block. He's whiffing. He's getting out the way. Look, I like his game on the offensive side of things. I just feel like in order to be the MVP, and this year I'm going with probably Giannis or Gilgeous Alexander, you got to be able to do it on both sides in the NBA at a high level and contribute that helped you win ball games. So I don't know. Where are you at with it, BD? You know, do you agree or you're not rolling?
Okay, it's a Joker defensive rating is estimating the number of points a player allows per 100 possession. Okay. His defensive rating stands at 110.
Okay. So that's pretty bad. The higher the number, the worse.
110 in today's NBA is not that bad, actually.
Well, that's true. That's true.
That's true. You know, top defensive teams are giving up, you know, 110, 108, 109.
All right.
Okay. And then Giannis, his defensive rating this year is 109.
Yeah.
Oh.
Right.
That's a lot better, though. That's a point better. So I'm going with Giannis.
All right, man. But Baron, I'm going to let you go, man. But before we do, Bart Oatmeal, where you at with that? Your alter ego? I mean, you got a whole rap thing going on, man. It's been beautiful to watch develop over the years. Just quickly talk about that and we'll get you out of here.
Yeah, shout out to OatmealRadioCafe.com. I decided, in my second career, I wanted to be a creative. And I really wanted to start making music, producing music, because I was making content and I was selling shows, but they wouldn't let me direct. They wouldn't let me act. So I was like, man, maybe I can just make the music and be a music supervisor. And then that translated into making beats. The beats translated into nobody rapping to my beats. So I had to rap to my own beats to try and upsell them.
It worked.
You know, I just started connecting with a lot of my goal was I started studying rap and saying everybody in rap is an alter ego. Like when you think about it, what is Busta Rhymes' real name? YG, everybody has a mantra, has an alter ego, has a WWE character and a persona. And so that's how Bart Oatmeal came about, was like, how can I build a persona of, an artist that can articulate what LA looked like from the hood to Santa Monica, Inglewood, like how do you implement all of this LA texture into a sound, right? That I wanted to convey out, that I felt like, could be my own. And so just looking at rap, it was just another outlet similar to basketball, where it's like an opportunity to just, to heal, right? To speak, to communicate. Like a lot of times you just got to let the screams out or say what you got to say. And so that's why I chose that. And, it was just an extension of my writing. And now Bart Oatmeal, Steel Cut 1 is out. My birthday coming up, April 13th, Steel Cut 2 coming out. We got Live from the Swap Meet. Then we going into the year of love, you know, because I got a message.
Live from the swap meet.
Hey, boss, I got a whole soul album. I got a soul group called the Ghetto Ball. Yeah, we gonna have the Soul Sundays here, Slick.
Y'all yeah, cracking.
You may catch me singing some backgrounds. You know,
so good, bro. Listen, man,
we got a whole 70s vibe. Whoa. Yeah.
I am so proud of you, man, and not just what you've accomplished as a ball player, but even more so, man, the things that you're doing now, man. And you're just, again, one of the most iconic figures in Los Angeles sports history, and it's just been a privilege to know you and continued success in everything you do. And you're the golden child. Whatever you touch just turns to gold, man. And it's just been a privilege having you on here, District, man. Thanks for taking the time to join us, Baron.
Yeah, I give you a lot of credit for just paving the way. You've always been an example of, like, all the different things that an L.A. basketball player can do, an L.A. person can do, you know,
Richard.
From acting to announcing to, you know, being my Hall of Famer. Let's say that, to being my Hall of Famer and my Hall of Fame, right? And you left a trail, right, that – you know, through Chris, I had the privilege of, like, even knowing more, right, about the legacy. Through Nelly, asking him, even knowing more, right? So, you know, there'd be no Steven Jackson if there's no Marcus Johnson, right? Yeah. And so,
breadcrumbs, you know, breadcrumbs, think, baby. That's some breadcrumbs for y'all. Some breadcrumbs, man.
And Chris just being a big bro, our time at UCLA, I just, you know, I think this is a cool show, a dynamic show, Chris. You know, is one of the smartest dudes that I've ever met in my life. And I think I adopted a lot of his personality, you know, as a freshman at UCLA. He used to call me Thy Covenant. And me and
Thy
Earl.
Covenant. Thy Covenant.
Thy Covenant.
Thy Covenant.
Hey, dude, but Chris.
The Covenant.
Chris.
Thy Covenant.
Chris, I thought it was a compliment for about 2 months until me and Earl was sitting in the dorm. I was like, dude, why does he keep calling us Thy Covenant? Like, is like, what is that?
Oh, that's hilarious. All right, man, get out of here. Go sign your record deal, man. We thank you so much.
Thank you, man. Love you, man. Congrats.
Love you too, boy.
All right, here in District, Marcus Johnson, captain of this vessel. We wanted to thank Baron Davis, one of the most iconic figures in basketball lore.
Easily.
And especially L.A. You talk about L.A., it's funny, and Chris, we were talking to Baron about, you know, where he would rank in terms of point guards. I said somewhere in that top 3 to 5, and he was like 2 at the lowest behind Raymond Lewis. And that's Baron, you know, and that's how Baron is. He's got his confidence with – it's swag and confidence without being boastful or you know, obnoxious. You know what I'm saying? And he's always been that way.
No, and that's how he played the game, and that's how he carries himself and everything that he does, which makes him why he's BD. He's the lovable BD.
B Diddy. The coveted. The coveted.
thy coveted.
Thy coveted.
Earl. Thy coveted freshman.
Thy coveted. That was funny. But listen, man, so, and speaking of iconic, and in turn, we talked to Baron about, you know, Hall of Fame. He had some great insights behind that, and that's a topic that's personal to me. Once again, I was a finalist for the NBA Hall of Fame, the Naismith Hall of Fame. Let me make sure I clarify that, because it's not the NBA Hall of Fame. It's the Naismith Hall of Fame, the National Basketball Hall of Fame.
Yep.
So what you've done all throughout your basketball career, your high school career, your collegiate career, what you did as a professional. So, but it's not just the NBA. And so there's a guy by the name of John DeLiva who's been my personal grim reaper, Chris, because he's the guy that's responsible for delivering the glad tidings or the bad tidings. And let's take a listen to kind of what it sounds like. Let's take a listen to what disappointment sounds like.
Hi, Mr. Johnson. It's John DeLiva at the Naismith Basketball Hall of Fame calling. I'm calling to tell you, unfortunately, you did not receive the required number of votes to be elected to the class of 2025. Thank you for being a part of this consideration.
Yeah, so that's the crux of it. And it's funny, Chris, the first time I got that call from John, the Grim Reaper, I was with Walter Mosley, a great novelist.
You were with Walter Mosley?
We were on a transatlantic flight from New York LaGuardia to LAX, sitting in first class. I was telling him this was the day I was going to get the news. He kind of Googled me and said, "Oh no, looking you up, you belong in the Hall of Fame. You got to make it." And so as we're walking down the hallway of LAX, headed to baggage claim, I look at my voicemail and I see John DeLiva and the Hall of Fame is called, and I want to let Walter share in on some of this good news because I'm one of his biggest fans in the world. I've read every book that he's written. And so I play the voicemail, and it's the disappointing news that you didn't make it. And Walter Mosley almost shed a tear. He was so hurt. He was more hurt than I was. He's like, "I don't believe that. I can't believe that. Are you kidding me?" You know, and so that was that first time. Second time, I got the news. Clyde Frazier called me and told me, you know, he had been denied a few times, and then to F them and don't let them define who I was. I was a basketball player. So here's the third time. And you know, I didn't talk about it a lot to you or anybody else in the family, people close to me, about the prospects, how I was feeling when people would say, "Well, oh yeah, you're definitely going to get in this time at the looking at the body of work and compared to other people that are eligible." You know, it's disappointing without question, to not, get the call that says that you've been elected as a Hall of Famer, because there's something special about that, being inducted into that elite group of athletes that I've so admired all throughout my lifetime. But at the same time, Chris, if it's going to happen, it's going to happen. If it's not, it's not. I can't worry about things I can't control. And as Baron Davis talked about on our podcast, you know, it's all about what the peers remember you as. And for me, you know, the guys I played against, the Alex Englishes of the world, who was my backup in Milwaukee at the small forward spot, Bernard King, a guy that I had some great battles with, Walter Davis, my rookie year, Larry Bird, Dr. J, James Worthy. I mean, you go on down the list of all these tremendous, tremendous forwards. And I was in the golden age of forwards, too. When I played between Bird and Dominique and Bernard King and Dr. J, and you know, and off night you might have a Larry Nance at 6'10" at the small forward, who was a tremendous player. Who was a tremendous player in his own right. So you know, Chris, then that means something. It's about the mark that you left with your peers, and I say that to you too, because I mean, you're another guy who doesn't quite get the credit when they're talking about all-time greats out of L.A., two-time state champion from Crenshaw High School, national champion at UCLA, the resume, the senior year at UCLA, 18, 19 points a game, 20-plus points a game in conference play. You know, it's trust me, the people that you played against, bro, they respect who you are, what you were as a player, and the problems that you created in their lives on the basketball floor. So yes, the Hall of Fame means a lot. It would mean a lot. It would be special. But at the same time, it doesn't define. I can't define my insides about what you think of me on the outside. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And so my inside as a man, as a ball, I've overcome so much. Substance abuse. I've been sober coming up on 23 years now. To me, that's one of my greatest accomplishments. I mean, yeah, we can clap to that. That's one of my greatest accomplishments. And so, you know, from the doorway of death, you know, to being able to turn my life around. So the Hall of Fame would be special, but it's not going to make or break who I am. And I don't know, not that I think people would expect that. On a certain level, the disappointment, they would expect that. But at the same time, you know, we're built from different stock. You and I, this family, the patriarch and matriarch of our family, then goes beyond that to my ancestors and the journey that they've had. One of the things that's special about how we were brought up, I was able to get from my mom and dad, you know, like a griot, old-fashioned griot storyteller, stories of just kind of things that we've had to overcome as a family, as a people. And so the Hall of Fame is special. Don't get me wrong, man. But, man, life is special, and raising a family of high achievers and children that are doing positive things in their life, and they're spending time with me when they don't have to. I mean, those are the things that mean more to me than anything else in the world, and that have the ultimate value in my life today. So yes, Hall of Fame would be great, but man, if it'll happen, it'll happen. If it doesn't, it doesn't in life, and life goes on.
Well, and yeah, to your point about your peers, MJ, every basketball experience that I've ever had in my life, whether it be training camp with the Denver Nuggets, where Clyde Drexler and Kiki Vandeweghe was the GM and Clyde Drexler was assistant coach, but you know, and Louis Dampier was an assistant coach. So all three of these guys, when I'm at camp, made it a point to spend 10, 15 minutes talking to me, treating me a certain type of way, showing me love. But then ultimately, you were the top of the conversation throughout my whole basketball life. So the validation from your peers is there. Whether or not the Hall of Fame, the Naismith Hall of Fame thinks you're a Hall of Famer, as you just said, is irrelevant. You are a Hall of Famer to us. You're a Hall of Famer to an entire generation, to all your kids, everybody that loves you. And you have had a Hall of Fame, in my opinion, post kind of career, where this thing with the substance abuse, dude, like the way people really don't understand. I was there, so I understand the full scope of everything on who you were and on who you are. Bro, it's just like one of the most amazing things I've ever seen done. But MJ, before we let you go, before we end this, there's some folks that have something to tell you about what they think about you.
Mr. Johnson, Marcus, God bless you with an unbelievable talent. You touched a lot of people's lives, including mine.
You inspired me in so many different ways. You forced me to be a better basketball player.
You know, once I saw Marcus, I knew that my time at the top of the forward list was going to be short. I just wish him the best.
I got to see him, you know, from the beginning. He was a great player, number one.
That California style of play.
The other teams, who are great players too, had a hard time defending him.
I just thank you for who you are and what you meant to the game. Don't get too high, don't get too low.
You are loved, respected, and greatly appreciated, not only for being a great player, but also a tremendous person.
You're going to be always a Hall of Famer through the Bucks eyes, always. Not just the organization, but through the city of Milwaukee.
Coop slapped me. man.
How you like that? How you like that, bro?
I feel like crying, man. That's special, man. Thank you so much for putting that together. And
bonus.
And we talk about the peers, man. And that you know, and listen, and guys like that don't just blow smoke up your behind just for the sake of it. You know what I mean?
No, they don't. No, they know, don't.
They would say some gracious things, but when we talk about, you know, who we respect as basketball players, I mean, we speak from the heart. We speak it honestly. And that's something that has tremendous value to me. All right. Your district, man, got emotional around here today. What a great, great show. And Chris, thank you. And our producers, Monas and Dylan, for hooking that up, man. And
they got it.
That means a lot.
This has been a Bucks Plus audio production.